If I wanted to go with a Halloween season theme here, and I do, I'd say today's show has a dark and scary night, the ghost of Toys R Us, and the invasion of the social media body snatchers. Also, the stock market. Terrifying. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, October 8th. Good to have you with us. We're starting today here in California, where the lights will go out for close to a million people starting around midnight tonight. It is hot, dry, and windy in Northern California, and the state's largest electric utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, says it'll turn off the power to prevent fires. Its power lines have caused or potentially caused several devastating wildfires in recent years, but this will be by far the state's biggest preventative power outage. And as climate change makes fire seasons, hurricanes, and extreme weather worse across the country, this isn't an isolated story for homes, schools, and businesses. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on what happens when the plug gets pulled.
Becky Urbano is keeping a close eye on her phone, so long as it still has juice. The Oakland resident has been alerted her home and two kids' schools could lose power in the outage.
Really, we're kind of on call. If power goes out, we have to go get the kids and they come home. There's really no other option for us.
Work will have to take the back seat for Urbano's family and much of the region. A report from utility research firm eSource found power outages cost U.S. businesses an estimated $27 billion a year. Catherine Wolfram is an expert on energy policy at UC Berkeley, which is also bracing for the outage. She says events like these can really cripple business.
It's just not something that our economy is equipped to deal with.
At the university, she says experiments have been canceled and labs will have to throw out some perishable materials. Outages can have outsized effects on industries that rely on refrigeration, like healthcare and food services. In parts of the world where electricity is unreliable, Wolfram says businesses have no choice but to incorporate the cost of backup power into their budgets, upwards of $10,000 for a commercial generator.
That becomes essentially like a tax on the economy.
It's a cost that Nick's restaurant in Paradise, California, is willing to pay. The town was almost completely destroyed in the state's deadliest wildfire in history last year. Now, the restaurant's got a backup generator to the backup generator, says kitchen manager Joe Pickett.
So that our food stays good and we can still run paninis and a coffee machine. And it's a time and age where we've got to be ready for anything that comes.
Part of the new business as usual for fire-weary residents. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Toys R Us shut down entirely in 2018 after filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy with more than $5 billion of debt on its books. My 7-year-old niece still isn't over it. But the ghost of Toys R Us lives on. If you head to the Toys R Us website, which, yes, still exists, and you try to buy something, it will redirect you to Target.com. That's right, Target and the creditors that own the Toys R Us brand have struck a holiday shopping deal. Marketplace's Mariel Segura explains.
After Toys R Us shut down last year, the brand name was left in the hands of the creditors that had lent money to the company.
Effectively a cohort of banks that are now in the toy business.
Stephanie Wissink is a managing director at Jefferies. Now those banks are trying to figure out how to make money off the Toys R Us brand.
And it's a very challenging thing to do because their infrastructure was totally dismantled last year.
James Zahn, senior editor at The Toy Book, says those creditors are opening a handful of small stores, and through this deal with Target, they're monetizing the name itself. Say it's the holidays. I'm looking for a toy for my cousin's kid. I think to myself, is Toys R Us still around? And I try the website. Merle Gokey, a managing director at Alex Partners, says there are a lot of people who'll do this.
I wouldn't rule out Toys R Us being one of the top names that they would go and Google.
So back to my cousin's kid. I'm on ToysRUs.com, looking around. Click on the action figure category. 818 results. Oh, nice. There's a Black Widow version of Mrs. Potato Head. Click on that. And underneath, there's a button that says, buy now at Target.com. The toy will come from Target's inventory. Target will ship it to me. Toys R Us is operating in name only. We don't know exactly how much Target paid for this deal, but Stephanie Wissink at Jefferies says there's a lot of potential business here.
almost $500 million of Toys R Us' total business was online. And I think this certainly, from a Target perspective, they want to get as much of that $500 million as possible.
Because Target is competing with Walmart and Amazon to fill the void Toys R Us left when it shut down. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the U.S. blacklisted dozens of Chinese companies, and hopes for trade talks this week were dim. Stocks fell. In Europe, stocks fell for all the same reasons, plus a fresh set of hell around Brexit. We've got details on the Brexit drama in this week's Make Me Smart podcast, hosted by me and Kai Rizdahl, and details on the market drama when we do the numbers. For the last several months or so, over on my show, Marketplace Tech, we've been asking what the tech industry can do to help us adapt to climate change. And so far, we focused on companies, but today we're going to focus on people. Because Silicon Valley, home of the tech industry, is also a microcosm of economic and racial inequality. And that is a climate change story, too. Here in Silicon Valley, you see this dynamic playing out in the tiny town of East Palo Alto. It's sandwiched in between Palo Alto, home of Stanford and Menlo Park, which is where you'll find Sand Hill Road and venture capital millions. But it doesn't really benefit from any of that.
Let's be honest, East Palo Alto has been the city that has been left out of the equation on many occasions.
Lisa Gaucher is the mayor of East Palo Alto. Its streets are crowded with tech commuter traffic just passing through. Its median house price is about $1 million. The median income is about $52,000 a year. People have been pushed out.
A lot of our residents are still, they're not qualified or not able to get the jobs that will pay them a living wage and allow them to stay in their community.
The city has approximately 30,000 residents. It's a mostly black and brown community with a higher poverty rate than the national average, despite sitting in one of the richest counties in the U.S. East Palo Alto is also at risk from climate change. Half of it is in a flood zone. Any major rainstorm causes streets to close, sewers to overflow, and streets to fill up with water. And East Palo Alto isn't prepared to adapt to worsening climate change.
We started listening to the community leaders, and there was a big gap on adaptation planning.
Violet Saena works for the nonprofit Actera, which works to get green tech like solar panels and energy-efficient windows to low-income communities. She said in some cases, the tech to make homes more resilient, like more energy efficient as temperatures get hotter, is available to people for free, but it's hard to get it to them.
The information is only available online. Homeowners are elderly homeowners who don't have access to Wi-Fi or a computer. When it comes to the application itself, it's like a 10-page, and they ask for your family's income. All of this paperwork, it really like discourages people to apply.
Saena says her organization can get people really big subsidies to switch to electric vehicles that they can power for free with low-cost solar panels, but people tell her that tech just isn't for them.
When they see an electric vehicle or a Tesla, because we do ride-and-drive events where people can come and see these electric vehicles, you can even drive them. The one thing they say, that's for a rich man. We can't afford that.
And then there are those in East Palo Alto who say they don't want to be guinea pigs for tech that they didn't have input in developing.
Community engagement is not true community engagement if you aren't sharing power.
Ophelia Bayo is the executive director of Youth United for Community Action, an environmental justice group in East Palo Alto. It's a place where kids gather to talk about what battles to fight in the community. A few years back, they managed to help kick out a hazardous waste facility that had been polluting groundwater in East Palo Alto. And also to do things like work on their resumes and get mentorship and advice.
No, the resume, like on job, new job.
I wrote it.
Bayo says the tech industry needs to get engaged on climate change.
In that same breath, though, tech has a huge social responsibility to the neighboring cities that they operate in, even their host cities that they operate in, because they simply have the means to do something about it.
But she echoed a fear we heard often, that solutions will come at too high a price.
You don't try to solve a climate crisis by extracting more wealth and selling clean air in a can to people who can afford it, right? Or whatever the wonky solution, weird solution is.
To be sure, no solutions, wonky or otherwise, seem to be coming from the tech industry right now. But just last month, East Palo Alto did get a $4.4 million federal grant to improve roads and drains and protect the city from future flooding. You can hear more from that series, How We Survive, about how tech is and isn't helping us adapt to climate change. You'll find it all at marketplace.org/climate. With the 2020 election on the horizon, social media is still considered a crucial tool for candidates and journalists during the campaigns. But as we hopefully learned from the last election and all the months since then, bots and fake accounts are flooding the social media zone to amplify false information or create division and discord. Filippo Menser is a professor of informatics and computer science at Indiana University. He estimates that around 10 to 15% of accounts on Twitter are fake, despite the company's efforts to shut them down. And those accounts have a big impact on what we think is true. Filippo, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So let's just get super specific. I mean, how big a problem is that, considering that so many journalists use Twitter, so many political candidates are using Twitter to see how their messages are resonating?
We believe that it is an important problem because the platforms and we, the users of the social media platforms, are vulnerable to manipulation. Those could have real world implications, for example, on, you know, when we go to vote. But it's hard to prove that causal chain of events. We do know, however, that bots can be used effectively to manipulate what information we are exposed to online and to make it look like certain things are trending and to generate the appearance that some people or some ideas are particularly popular. And that can also trick journalists, because if they then think that this is what people are talking about, then they can cover it. And that generates a second wave of attention.
Right. And then tell me why it's so hard to solve this problem, to even detect these bots, let alone get rid of them.
Yeah, it is a very difficult problem. First of all, platforms are inundated with these kinds of abuse. So even if you have a very good machine learning algorithm that detects the great majority of them, even missing just a few, that will still have, you know, millions, many millions of potentially fake accounts. And many of them use humans to actually generate the content so that you cannot easily spot patterns of bots. And then finally, the platforms can pay a huge price for suspending an account, because even if it was using for abuse, it is hard to prove. The person who was using those bots can then say, look, I'm a human, I posted these things myself. And it is very difficult to prove otherwise.
How many followers does a bot need before it can have a significant impact on our online conversations?
We've tried to explore that question by building a model that simulates a social media network. So we actually measured the amount of damage that bots can do in such a network. And it seems that when roughly around 1% or so of the humans follow a bot, then there is a very big transition from a situation in which the bots have not so much of an effect to a situation in which they have a huge effect. So if I want to target a particular community, for example, people who are vulnerable to conspiracy theories, then I can create a bunch of bots that for a while just retweet and mention people in this community, and they follow them, and then they get followed. And after a while, they can become integral part of that community. And at that point, they can basically control it.
Well, and there's an effort now, a law in California, and a discussion about maybe federal efforts to sort of force bots to identify themselves when they're interacting with people, especially around political messaging. What are the complications around that solution?
I believe that that seems like a very reasonable thing, but there are those who argue that this is an infringement on First Amendment, that bots somehow have free speech rights. The idea is that there is somebody behind those bots, and those people should not be limited in what they say. On the other hand of the spectrum, there are opinions, including mine, that say that if you don't impose any limits on that kind of speech, then you are allowing people to suppress other people's speech, because I can create thousands of fake accounts, and just by flooding the network with junk, I can basically keep other people who are real humans from being heard.
Filippo Menser is professor of informatics and computer science at Indiana University. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you very much, Molly.
Coming up, that data is shared with researchers who obviously are paying you.
Making money off your digital footprint. But first, let's do the numbers. It could be worse. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 313 points, 0.1%, to close at 26,164. The NASDAQ lost 132 points, that's 0.6%, to finish at 78.23. And the S&P 500 fell 45 points, 1.5%, to close at 28.93. Companies caught in the tensions between the U.S. and China took a hit. Image processing firm Ambarella dropped 0.9%. One of its Chinese clients, Hikvision, was among 28 Chinese firms blacklisted by the U.S. government today. Several other firms fell on reports that the U.S. may limit Chinese stock holdings in government pension funds. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.53%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rima Khres, host of This Is Uncomfortable, a new podcast from Marketplace that explores the thing we're always in our feelings over but don't really know how to talk about: money. This is a storytelling podcast that digs into things like how someone can feel like an imposter when they move from one socioeconomic class to another, or why so many people lie about what's in their bank account. We'll even teach you how to ask everyone you know about how much they make. But just to be clear, this is not a personal finance podcast. It is a podcast about life and how money messes with it. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. American teenagers are spending less money. They spend just under $200 a month. That is the least they have spent since 2011. And that is according to a survey of nearly 10,000 U.S. teens by the investment bank Piper Jaffray. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports on what they are and aren't spending their money on and what is a brand to do.
Food and clothes are the two biggest spending categories for teenagers, according to the survey. Food for boys, clothes for girls. And although overall teenage spending is down 4% since the last survey 6 months ago, teens have continued to spend on technology. Mike Olson tracks e-commerce for Piper Jaffray.
Teens are interested in trying to ensure that they're having all the devices that they need to kind of keep up with their ability to consume the content that they want to consume.
Like social media sites, says Jenny Vrij-Lew with the Center for Customer Insights at Yale. And they're
really following people more than they are following brands.
Those people, influencers, celebrities, other teens, help them decide what to spend their money on, like footwear and athleisure wear. Teenage girls, their favorite clothing item, leggings. There's one thing teenage girls are spending a lot less on: handbags. Back in 2006, they were spending $197 a year on them. In this latest survey, that's down to $90. Barbara Kahn, a marketing professor at Wharton, says that's to be expected.
Well, if you're wearing casual clothes, you're presenting yourself in that look, but that look doesn't require accessories in the same way. So you don't need a handbag. You don't need some of the fancy accessories which young people used to buy.
Or it could be that since everything's on their phones, maybe they just don't need handbags. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Free These services like Facebook, Google, and Twitter aren't completely free, which again, I hope we all realize by now. You're actually trading your data for access to those sites. And a growing number of people think that you should actually be paid for sharing that information. Now, two startups are working together to figure out how to make that exchange happen. One collects and encrypts your data. Another shares that data with paying companies with your permission. Dana Budzin is the co-founder and CEO of Ubdi, the second app in the mix. Dana, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Let's go straight to how Ubdi works. What did you come up with as a strategy?
Yeah, so we do allow individuals to aggregate their own data across different applications and accounts, like Fitbit, Spotify, credit cards, and then we give these people a vehicle to basically share anonymized insights from that data with paying companies and researchers and nonprofits, all while protecting their, you know, privacy and identity. Once you've linked your accounts, you're able to click in. It'll tell you we're looking at finance and we're looking at coffee trends. So we want to analyze Starbucks or Pete's coffee spending, whatever it may be. And then you swipe to consent and that data is shared with researchers who obviously are paying you.
How then do you protect that data? Obviously, you're talking about a pretty big treasure trove here.
Right. So our partner DigiMe, they don't see, touch, or hold the data. They give you the only key to access this and then allow you to share that data with apps like ours when you choose. Mm. It's actually a two-app system, which is very non-traditional. So we're minimizing any of the data that leaves your device. So neither us at Ubdi or any of our partners know who you are. And we ensure that no profiles are being built on people.
And then just on the purely mercenary side of things, how much do you expect that a consumer could make participating with Ubdi?
I think for some people, it will be hundreds. I think for many people, it will be thousands. And then I think there will be other communities of people. Maybe it's in the future of medical data or whatever it is, some special things about you that make you unique, that it will be that, you know, thousands upon thousands of dollars, maybe $5,000 to $10,000.
Let's be explicit about why would some people make more? Why is some data, you know, more valuable than others?
Yeah. A lot of people think when I say that rich people are going to get richer. And that's the concern, right? That they're like, oh, well, the CEOs are going to be the ones that people want to reach out to. I don't actually think that's true because in emerging countries around the world, in places where there is a lack of data, there's a lot of spend happening to find out how to boost communities up. And instead, they could just be putting that money into people's pockets because they know best, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think, of course, there will be the CEOs who someone might pay for an hour of their time and spend a lot of money. But I also think there's this opportunity for low-income individuals that are unique.
And then how does Ubdi make money?
Yeah, so we take 20% of what companies are paying and 80% goes straight back to the individual. So pretty easy transaction fee there.
One just kind of last philosophical question is that sometimes when you talk about the idea of paying people for their data, you will have privacy experts who say, okay, but you're still buying into a flawed system. Like you're still buying into a system that relies on people's data. And wouldn't it be better if we just didn't do that? And I wonder, like, is this still just sort of allowing people to participate in a system that's going to just want more of their information forever?
You know, it's interesting. For one, there's different nonprofits and other, you know, local governments that we're opening up access to and helping them. But also part of privacy, which people somehow seem to forget, is about choice. And you should have ownership over your data and you should be able to choose for yourself. But at the end of the day, one, this is a step in absolute better direction than the data economy we have today. And part two, giving people choice, I think, is always the better path.
Dana Budzin, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note on the way out is about the NBA's troubles with China. Beijing is canceling preseason games, and Chinese companies are pulling NBA gear and endorsements after the general manager of the Houston Rockets tweeted support for pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. Today, Sports Illustrated suggested the NBA should stop doing business with China completely, but the NBA really wants those 500 million basketball fans in China, and lots of NBA players are making big bucks selling sneakers there. HoopsHype.com listed all the players with big sneaker deals with Chinese companies like Li Ning, Anta, and Peak. Golden State Warriors star Klay Thompson's deal to become the, quote, Michael Jordan of Anta is worth some $80 million. And that is that for now. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 313 points, about 1.1%. The NASDAQ lost 132 points, 1.6%. The S&P 500 down 45 points. That is 1.5%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the Executive Director of Digital. Satara Nieves is our Executive Director of On-Demand. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.